You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
He didn't even know what a mechanical engineer was. He just heard of it, thought like, that sounds okay. That sounds like a good thing, so I'm going to lean into that.
We all have that friend, Mr. Wood, who's just like, oh, I just happen to be amazing at anything I do, and I'm not like even trying.
I wouldn't say I relate in that sense, but I did find myself like feeling a little bit of kinship with Calder because of the fact that like, I am where I am because of my friend's intervention. Like, my parents encouraged me to accept the academic scholarships that I had earned and go off to study medicine. I wanted to be a musician and bounced around doing that for a little while until my friends sort of had an intervention and said, like, you know, every band you've played in is kind of terrible and you're not that great as a musician, but you're okay as an artist. You're okay as a visual artist. And so, like, my self-appointed life coach, a friend who was a year older than me, dragged me to the Art Institute for their immediate decision day. And she was just like, you need to be an art teacher. And like my portfolio was literally like just bundled to get like wrapped in twine. It was just a stack of paintings and drawings, but I got in.
You are the world's okayest art teacher.
I feel like I should splice in Groundskeeper Willie singing, wouldn't it be adequate? But okay is good enough.
And sometimes it okay really, really is. In these unprecedented times, it really is.
Yeah.
Good. There's a book called Okay for Now.
There's a less rough book for the younger set. I think it's called It's Okay to Be Okay. Illustrations are the okay guy, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I like that guy. Oh, yeah. First graders used to do that book all the time.
I feel like who art Ed?
I'm trying to slice it.
Who art Ed?
Mr. Wood art Ed me.
Good. Either way, it's ambiguous. It works on so many levels.
I know.
That's
off
to a great start.
Welcome to Who Arted, where we explore visual arts in an audio medium. I'm your host, Kyle Wood, and joining me today is my favorite librarian, Tony Kressel. Thanks for joining me.
Good to be here. Thank you so much, Kyle, Mr. Wood, sir.
Sir. Ooh. That made me feel old. Today, we are going to be looking at and talking about the work of Alexander Calder. And this week, as in every week, you can find the work we're looking at linked in the show notes, as well as on my website, whoartedpodcast.com. That's right. Getting more professional for season two.
I like that.
Today, we're talking about Alexander Calder. And I appreciate that, just like with our first episode, you actually brought this one to me. You know, obviously I'd heard of Calder before, but I always love it when a guest talks about work that they are familiar with and appreciate. So you mentioned that you wanted to talk about Streetcar, which is on display not currently on display, but it is housed at the Art Institute of Chicago, our hometown museum.
Yeah, I remember seeing this at some point in my life, and I've always been fascinated by hanging art for whatever reason. And when I talk about hanging art, I mean that mobile. Do you say mobile or mobile? Because I never remember the right way to say it.
I go back and forth. It's one of those things that I feel like either pronunciation seems okay. I have a weird thing about pronunciation because I always think like, do we want it to sound more understandable, like it's a mobile sculpture, or it's a mobile? Like, It sounds like you're adding an accent to like get it closer to the French because Marcel Duchamp is the one who coined the term.
Yeah, I had no idea when I was doing when I got some of the background information. I'm like, oh, so it actually comes from this work that Calder is kind of presented to us. I like mobile because I think it separates it and describes that hanging piece. If you just say it's mobile, it feels like you can take it somewhere. Like, come on, Calder, let's go to the beach and like hang out and like hang your little thing. So I like mobile, but I always feel funny saying it. I'm right there with you.
Yeah. And to me, it's just like at a certain point, it's to each his or her own. You
so
know,
this is a Calder mobile and we'll just look at it.
Sick de Calder.
Right.
You know,
So I am just drawn to things that are kind of unique and kind of step out from what had been done. I think when you look at art in different forms, this is got some abstract pieces to it, but it also has that kinetic motion to it, which just fascinates me because the more you read about it, the more you go, oh, this guy was really thinking deeply about it. And I think that's what sometimes we miss when we're working with students and working with art is that if you're just a regular Joe like I am in terms of art, I don't think all about it. I'm like, oh, that's a nice painting. Look at the colors. Look how bright that is. Look how dark that is. And then you start to really dig into a piece and you appreciate it more and more because of like what the artist's intent was and how the artist wants you to view it. It's so that interaction, that play with art is just something that honestly I haven't come to till recently in my life. I'd never thought about how we're supposed to interact with art. Instead of just like, look at it. I know what performance art is and I get all that because I have fine arts background, but like seeing that, like, what am I taking away from this art piece? What am I seeing? And how am I seeing it uniquely? And I love that about Calder because every time you see Streetcar, it's going to look different. It just is because of the way it moves in its motion. So you have this like ability to kind of never see the same piece of art twice, even though yes, it's the same materials. It's in a different form, it's in a different light, it's in a different piece of motion. It's just fascinating to me.
That it is interesting. And, you know, as you talked about like the research piece and his intention and all of that, I think we've got to start by going back to, you know, like a little bit of his background, and then we'll get deeper into, you know, the connections and the inferences and everything with Streetcar. So, you know, he was born 1898, August 22nd, according to his mother, but according to official papers, July 22nd, which I always find, like, that's the first thing I found really funny is, you know, is this a situation where someone made a mistake in the records office? Or is this a situation where, like, his mom misstated something once and then just everyone was like, nope, we're not correcting her. Like that's your new birthday.
It's
now
too much paperwork, you know? To fix it.
Like,
right.
But yeah, he was born in Lawton, Pennsylvania. He moved around a bit, because unfortunately, like 1905. So he was like 7 years old. His father had tuberculosis. His parents, had him stay with family for a year while they went to Arizona to try to sort of seek treatment. And then he rejoined his family in Arizona, moved to California. Then from California, they went to Philadelphia, then to New York. So it's like he was in motion throughout his life.
Ooh, I like that parallel. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think especially during that Gilded Age, we had a lot of things changing in the world. You know, we're pre-World War I, but we're at this turn of the century, and like suddenly the fruits of the Industrial Revolution are really starting to come home. We're starting to see we had factories, but now we're starting to get things like Ford's assembly line is revolutionizing how cars are going to be produced and how all this, and Calder is a young man at this point and is starting to see these things in motion. And as we talk about his career choices, I think we really start to kind of pull that in. We can start to see why he went the way he did.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, one of those early, as a young man, formative kind of experiences, you know, I should go back and mention, both of his parents were artists. Both his father and his grandfather were both sculptors. His mother was a portrait artist. And so he was around arts his whole life. And Alexander Calder, the youngest Alexander Calder, because both his father and grandfather were also named Alexander Calder. But the young Alexander Calder, the one that we're focused on, who became world famous later on, he actually worked with one of his father's friends. While he was in high school, they worked together making a mechanical gravity-powered sort of train system. And
I don't even know what that means, but it sounds pretty exciting.
Well, you know, it's essentially like a, you know, the way that a roller coaster works.
Oh, sure,
you know,
I do.
You got that chain that's pulling it up, and it goes over those different things, sort of like locking into place so it doesn't fall backwards.
So something you might use in mines or in sort of like repetitive transportation modes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Sure.
And he was doing it, you know, not large scale. It was more like a, you know, like a toy type system,
maybe,
you know,
a
like
proof of concept.
Train system. I got the sense that it was more like a hobbyist kind of thing.
Okay.
You know, but you know, he had, from what I understand, it was like an elevated thing. So, you know, the momentum from that first drop carries you through the rest of the system.
Potential energy transferring to kinetic energy. Yeah. Got it. I'm all over it.
Yeah, you know about the sciences. And so he was doing that in high school, working with a friend of his father's who was an artist. And his parents said, don't be an artist. Don't be an artist. They wanted him to do something else. And I just love how Alexander Calder just like, okay. You know, he just floats through, you know, from thing to thing. And a theme I noticed was he was just, people would make a suggestion and he was just open to it. He was like, he was that improv guy, just always yes and.
Do you find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Calm Cove podcast can help you sleep deeply all night long. Calm Cove has deeply relaxing meditation music and ambient sounds like ocean waves and crackling fires. All of our episodes are designed to help you relax and to fall asleep fast. Calm Cove is brought to you by the team behind Sleep Cove, the sleep podcast that consists of spoken word hypnosis, meditation, and stories. So if you want to listen to a beautiful soundscape tonight, search for Calm Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see how we're helping millions of people relax and go to sleep every night.
Have you ever wondered who the Mary was from Bloody Mary? If the Loch Ness Monster was real, or if Ouija boards actually worked? On each episode of the family-friendly Unspookable, we look at the histories and mysteries behind your favorite scary stories, myths, and urban legends to get the real stories behind the scares. Want to solve your next mystery? Find and follow Unspookable now wherever you get your podcasts.
So his parents said, don't be an artist. So he went off and became a mechanical engineer. He studied engineering and, he did that in 1915. From what I understand, he didn't even like really know what a mechanical engineer was. He just sort of heard the term and thought like, that sounds official. I'm going to adopt that.
Must be nice to make those choices.
You know, it's not a bad way to go.
Yeah.
Worked out well for him.
It did.
Sometimes listening to good advice pays off. So he studies mechanical engineering, and then around like 1926, somebody just suggested to him, like, why don't you start making mechanical toys? And he created Cirque Calder. It was miniature wire sculpted forms. Like, he also used found objects, string, cloth, cork. And he made these, like, fun little circus figures. And a friend of his suggested he submit them to the Salon des Humorists. In case you can't tell by my butchered accent here, we're talking about, like, he was in Paris at the time. And it was accepted, naturally, because Calder was brilliant. And it was displayed and became very popular both sides of the Atlantic. But Calder became especially popular with sort of the it crowd of avant-garde artists in Paris. So, like, he kept developing that craft, and he kept getting more and more into the art scene. And Marcel Duchamp, another famous artist of that time, actually coined the term mobile for Calder's work, because Calder, it didn't start off with the hanging, floating sculptures. It started off with sculptures that were on a base, and he had basically a motor to get moving parts.
Okay.
And so Duchamp like looked at that and he said, like, these are mobiles, and the others, I feel like it was someone else who said stables or stabiles.
Stables.
Stables. It was differentiating or coming up with a term to separate the moving or kinetic artwork from the stationary and stable.
So were these pieces that he was doing that were mobiles, were they repetitive motions? Were they kind of like, you know, feed the monkey and does the clapping, or is it like the...
Yes.
Okay, so those, yes, I know were tended to be pretty popular during those times, that automaton type of skill. You see it in like the invention of Hugo Cabret, where you have these things that can do specific tasks over and over again.
Yeah, he was making sculptures that were very sort of repetitive motion. And I think he got frustrated with that repetitive motion.
So was he the guy that did the bird that keeps dipping up and down? That wasn't him, was it?
Not to my knowledge.
What about like the Newtonian silver balls that keep going back and forth? Not his either?
No, not his.
Okay, just checking. I'm just trying to make sure. I'm trying to get my Calder locked in.
I feel like if I were to make a comparison to something that would be a familiar object, I feel like his early mobile sculptures that were like, they were on a pedestal, and then it was usually like an arm or something moving, almost like a metronome, kind of back and forth.
Okay.
And you might have some different elements that would move in different ways, but there was sort of a set path.
A defined rhythm to it as, yeah, well, probably.
Yeah.
Was it, and you said it was mechanically driven, or was it,
yes,
the human set it off to start it off?
No, it was mechanically driven in the early days.
Okay.
So he had a motor to them. And his real innovation, I feel like, where he had that sort of aha moment was when he looked at the sculpture and said, instead of it being on this base and coming up, it could be coming down from a higher, like the ceiling, and from like down, so that it's all suspended in air, and then the air currents can move the sculpture. Because the air currents are going to be a little bit less predictable, whether it is air currents that are caused by like wind blowing or like people's motion and breath in the room, you know, there's going to be that circulation of air that's going to move these sculptures in ways that they're non-repetitive. You know, it is something that is unique and different every time, as you alluded to from the beginning.
Yeah, I just am fascinated by how he designed it so you have some balance, but you also allow for entropy. You allow for, yeah, that. Here's how I created this. Now let's let the forces that are maybe invisible around us but still felt act out on this piece.
Yeah, and that's the thing that you know, his work, it's sort of deceptively simple. I think, you know, we always look at like the first mobiles we see are like suspended above a crib, and it feels like it is a child's toy. And he's elevating that in a totally different way. I think maybe this would be a good time for us to shift towards just like, let's look critically at Streetcar. That Streetcar from 1951, it's one of his mobiles at the Art Institute of Chicago. And, you know, do you want to start with, like, what do you see in here?
Well,
what's jumping out to you?
I see a lot of, like, this organic elegance. Like, I feel like it's almost like a skeleton or a nervous system to something. And everything is kind of like a neuroreceptors to it when you get these little circles that are there. But I love how everything just kind of, nothing is really straight and nothing is really jagged. There are a lot of curves to it, which has got to be hard to create in terms of balance. We have a few pieces that are set up straight, but for the most part, especially towards where it's hanging from, you have this just kind of gentleness to it. And I think that kind of, for me, it emotes, I get this emotional response to it where it's like, Oh, it's kind of smooth, it's flowing, it makes me feel good to look at this piece. It's not hypnotic or mesmerizing, but it just kind of sets me into, like, a moment where I can step back and really truly start to appreciate what's going on. And you have all these little pieces that are kind of moving, not fast, not like bright, shiny, but just kind of like cruising along in life. A lot like we think we've discovered that Calder did. He's just kind of like, yeah, here I am, just hanging out, letting the breeze take me where I need to go. You know, I can't remember the actual dimensions of this. In my mind, as I've seen it over the years, and of course this is a Mandela effect, I think it's huge, but it's probably not as big as I think it is. Do you have any idea where the dimensions are on it?
Let me look up the exact dimensions, because my estimate is, I want to say it's like 4 feet, but let me see. Okay, the dimensions are 42 by 116 inches.
Well, so that's, not, you know, that's
not
over
far off.
You know, that's 10 feet long. So okay,
10 feet
so
that, by 4 feet.
Yeah. So that does give it a sense of a little bit more than I was saying. And when you see things hanging, it kind of gives it that sense of this is big. It's not something that just like kind of slapped together. The other piece besides that organic and that flowingness to it is the balance to it. You see it and you don't feel like it looks like it should crash and like bang into each other and do all these things, but it doesn't. It's just kind of simply there. And I love that about it because it's got motion, but it also has this like stillness to it that kind of, like I said before, it kind of just puts me into the moment and calms me down.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that I'm noticing is, you know, you talked about how it seems like it should almost like crash into each other and everything like that. But, you know, these wires that everything is suspended from, they're very thin, delicate wires, like delicate looking wires. The shapes almost seem like they're just floating in air. Like, you know, from a distance or if you squint, the wires that form the structure and hold it all together just start to disappear.
Right.
You know, it almost becomes these free floating sort of circles, or not quite circles, but these organic shapes. I also, like, you talked about how soothing it is and how calming it is. And I think that's not an accident. I think that's, you know, the organic shapes and the curving lines, you know, the gentle curves and smooth organic shapes, they do tend to traditionally go along with a calm and soothing mood or tone. The fact that it's all powered by those air currents, so it's like it's moving in a gentle breeze at a slow pace. You know, it's not it's not powered by a motor that's going to have it just flying around the room at breakneck speed. It's this slow, calm meandering of these, you know, organic shapes floating above us. And it's all in this unified color scheme. You know what I mean? It's not bright or loud.
Right. And so then I'm trying to figure out, like, where does streetcar come from? And obviously you spent some time all over the country when these streetcars were pretty prevalent as in terms of transportation. So, is it because it's close to that same shape of one? Is it the motions of those circles? Are those like pedestrians or commuters getting on and off? And it just kind of shows how like a streetcar is always changing. Like you never have the same people on the same route at the same time. Like, is that where it comes from? I don't know if we have any reasons for why it was named that other than he liked it. But I try to find some reasoning, like my own interpretations of like, oh, I guess I could see like the dots are kind of spread out, like either someone's getting on or getting off, but it's always in motion. Especially like if you think about like the streetcars of like those classic in your mind's eye of like coming through in San Francisco, where you have like, okay, it's time for you to get on, it's time for me to get off. Before there was like, okay, now you got to swipe your pass or do all those other things. It was those open air types of things. And so I'm wondering if like, that was where his inspiration came from for it. Do we have any idea?
Well, like, before I cheat and go look it up, I'm just going to say, like, the connections that I draw to, like, between this and streetcar, like, it obviously has no real resemblance to
right.
a streetcar in terms of its physical appearance. But in terms of the materials, like, it looks like it's, like a sheet metal type thing. It has that, like, industrial material kind of feel to it.
Okay.
And my connection to Streetcar, I think of it almost like sort of the rhythms of movements, whether it could be like the rhythms of pistons firing, or it could be like the rhythms of traffic movement. You know, the way that like you say they're all moving together, but they're not bumping into each other. It's this coordinated dance of like traffic. You know what I'm saying?
That,
the
way that's
how I see it is it sort of takes like this industrial mechanization and the world that like when I think of the Industrial Revolution, I always think of like, you know, steamy factories that seem, you know, like the books that we read about, you know, problems in factories and everything that went wrong in the early days.
Oh,
before
so you're saying we're going to do Lewis Hines production. Next? We'll do some photography. That'd be great.
Yeah. But like what I see with Streetcar is it's sort of the more hopeful vision of that mechanism.
So,
you know, the Industrial Revolution. Yeah.
Almost a quiet strength to it.
Yeah, and it's like it's the ambition of those things.
Oh.
It's why we have the you know the assembly line. It's,
right. This is
the assembly line's
the
not
product.
There
this
because it's a
vision.
Fun place to work. It's you know it's because we want it to be because it serves a higher purpose, and it's we're seeing those elements come together in a beautiful way.
And that's kind of what I was going to jump off with you from that beautiful way. So it could be an admiration for this evolution of vehicles, or it could be an evolution. Like, this is where we've gotten. Look at how gorgeous this is. You know, you think about maybe this mechanical engineering background, and you say, and you take it and you merge it with art, and you say, I love how mechanics and engineering work together to create these automotive, these industrial pieces. But there's also like a quiet strength that says, this machine is just doing its job. It's kind of humming along quietly, even though they're not super quiet, but they're that quiet strength, that backbone to it, that kind of built these cities and allowed people to really move around as much as they needed to.
Yeah, I mean, it's not muscle car. It's not the brute strength of mm-hmm. the motor. It's appreciating the elegance of, you know, figures in motion and, you know, an elegant design, which I think, you know, an artist slash engineer, that's probably how he thought about these things, you know, as like an elegant design.
I wholeheartedly agree there. I think that's an excellent way to put it. And I have even more appreciation for the piece now that I'm staring at it.
Do you find it hard to sleep at night? Then the Sleep Cove podcast can help you. Hi, I'm Christopher Fitton, the voice and clinical hypnotherapist behind Sleep Cove. Sleep Cove features sleep hypnosis, meditations, and bedtime stories, all designed to help those of you who struggle at night to achieve a restful and peaceful night's sleep. Search for Sleep Cove on Apple Podcasts or Spotify and see why Sleep Cove helps millions of people sleep deeply all night long.
And so I'm wrapping it up.
I want
just a 3-point rating scale.
And
where should this hang? The Louvre? Is this something to look at? The lab? Is this something to learn from? Or the Louvre? British for the bathroom.
Yeah,
there's the a Louvre joke in there somewhere.
Oh, that's terrible.
I certainly don't think it's the last one. That understanding of this, how this artwork comes about, I think is important. I think that Calder did things that we didn't think about before, and he found ways to show what he sees the world as. Instead of doing these repetitive motions where he started, he said, I want the world to feel a little bit more free. I want my sculpture, my creations to kind of move with the world, but I also want to tie it back to this, what's going on in our world, this industrial piece, this automotive piece, whatever you want to call it. I think whenever we start talking about pieces that are new, at least for that time period, I think it's really important to show that to keep them in the forefront. Because even if we don't see it now, maybe you know we could make something like this and hang it in a hotel room and just call it art like you do with all those paintings that you see all the time. But to understand its historical significance is where I take a step back and go, okay. Plus, I think the emotions that it evokes, if you stop and still yourself a little bit, that mindful moment, this is a more powerful piece of that. We think about all those different types of things that kind of still us. You think about like wind chimes. You think about all those other hanging pieces that we see. Why do we do all those things? Well, because they put us into the present. And when you look at something like Calder, I think it forces us to be here, now, and mindful. And so I personally look at it and I go, this is really important.
So you see that as a museum piece. Like that is something to see, to appreciate, to be mindful, to take in.
I see this piece specifically because it was the forefront of it. If I go and make a mobile that looks a lot like it and I hang in my room, I'm probably not going to be like, oh, this is so pretty. But there's a reason that kids have mobiles hanging in their cribs. It's because it calms them. It stills them. It forces them to get all the other distractions away. And I think that Calder was kind of onto something with that.
Oh, certainly. Certainly. I actually have a very similar rationale.
Oh.
But
how are we going to fight then?
Well, for me, I would put this in the lab just because if I'm being 100% honest, I don't like it. I don't like the look of it. Like to me, it feels like a little bit of Moreau. It feels like other artists from that time. And I like the ideas behind it. I love kinetic moving elements. I love things that are interactive, that are breaking down the barrier between the artist and the audience. I do agree that there is something that is soothing about this piece to a lot of people. But I think for me, as I look at this, I personally am not going to linger on it. And I've seen a lot of people sort of pass by it. And I think there are really interesting ideas at play here. But I feel like the aesthetics just don't come together fully for me. When I look at this, he was actually influenced by Mondrian. He said like he was shocked into embracing abstract art after visiting Mondrian's studio. And Mondrian was the dude famous for the squares and rectangles, primary colors, right, like breaking it down to the simplest elements. And I look at this and I see a little bit of that influence of like you're breaking it down, you're distilling it down to these fundamental elements, simple organic shapes and wires that almost disappear to leave these floating forms. And there's something interesting about that idea. There's just something that I feel lacking in this. To me, visually, it's not as pleasant of an experience as it is intellectually. And that's where, to me, it seems like this is one for the lab, not the Louvre. Thank you very much for taking the time to join me.
My pleasure, Mr. Wood. It's always great to be here talking and learning from you about art and, you know, pushing my own narratives.
This concludes this week's episode of Who Arted? If you found this tolerable, please like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening. You can find images of the work being discussed this week and every week in the show notes on Twitter at WoodArtEd and on the website whoartedpodcast.com. Podcast done.